The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to stay on top of the latest news from China with our free daily email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, and of course, at the website itself, subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined from Nashville, Tennessee by the notorious Jin Yumi, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn. Greet the people, Jeremy.
Hey, people. Hey, Kaiser. How are you doing?
I'm well, man. Are you enjoying your vacation?
I am very much. I'm actually at home. It's kind of a staycation because my parents are in town visiting. I haven't seen them a long time because
the first time I've ever heard you use one of these idiotic American neologisms like staycation. But
staycation. It suits you well. They're getting to me. The Americans are.
Are you nervous about leaving the newsletter in my hands? I haven't utterly ruined it, have I?
So far, it's been great, Kaiser. So far, it's been great. You managed to avoid any cheesiness and, you know, very good. I approve. Okay.
Well, I'll slather on some cheese today. Anyway, today we are talking to Michael Bristow, who's Asia-Pacific editor for the BBC World Service. Michael was stationed in Beijing from 2005 to 2013, and he's written a book that Jeremy and I have both read. It's called China in Drag: Travels with a Crossdresser, in which Michael recounts his time in China, his travels, his reporting, and his myriad experiences through the prism of his relationship with his Chinese teacher, who is referred to throughout the book for reasons we're going to get into, simply as the teacher. The teacher is a Beijinger, and he's a really sensitive and observant man, very educated man. He's also a transvestite. So today, we're going to talk to Michael about cross-dressing in China and about notions of gender, not because that's really what this book is all about, but because, you know, that's its most conspicuous feature. Michael Bristow, welcome to Seneca.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're great, man. How are you?
Good. It's late here in London, but I'm all well.
Michael, I'd like to get straight to the story in your book that introduces the teacher and really is the reason for its name, China in Drag. Can you tell us why you decided to travel around China with your teacher and what happened on the first night of your trip?
Well, the fact that he's a cross-dresser came as a complete surprise to me. I decided long before I found out that information that I was going to write a book about him. And that's because, like many correspondents who spend time in China, I wanted to write something which went slightly beyond the day-to-day news agenda, the kind of the online, the TV and the kind of radio reports that we churn out daily as reporters wherever we're stationed. And I wanted to say something a little bit more profound. And for some time, I'd cast around for a subject, wondered what I wanted to talk about. And then kind of suddenly I realized over a period of kind of months, I think, that, you know, the person who sat opposite me twice a week to teach me Chinese was actually had come to, to my mind, personified China. He was born just 2 years after the Chinese Communist Party came to power. And his victories and disappointments throughout his life were mirrored by the country's own ups and downs. So in the Cultural Revolution, he stopped going to school. He was sent down into the countryside, like many and millions of other young people. So his experiences absolutely mirrored his country's, and also he's quite an ordinary person. He hasn't done anything particular. He hasn't held high office. He hasn't been a kind of powerful business person, but he is an educated, thoughtful person. And I thought by reflecting his life, I could kind of reach out to kind of people and let them know about ordinary Chinese folk, because that's one of the things I found difficult as a journalist, is trying to kind of convey in short reports to people outside China exactly what it was like to be Chinese and live in China.
So how did you decide on the trip? And, you know, tell us about the first night.
Yeah, how did you decide, for example, I mean, that it was going to take the form of a sort of travelogue?
Well, like lots of things in China, I used to sit as a journalist when I first went to China, and I used to try and call people on the telephone, and you would never be able to get through to people, or they'd kind of say they'd call you back, they'd never call you back. You'd have to send a fax with a list of questions on. Quite a lot of the time as a journalist, you'd ring kind of numbers and nobody would even bother to pick up the telephone at the other end. It was a really frustrating experience. So quite early on, I realised, like all good reports, I suppose, you've got to go out and you've got to actually see things for yourself, because unless you do that in China, you're going to find out absolutely zero. So as well as kind of retelling the story of this gentleman's life, I wanted to travel round to some of the places that had been associated with his life and some of the places which he wanted to show me, which illustrated some of the things he wanted to talk to me about. Because by doing that, we could have material for the book, we could spend time together, I could get to know him a little bit more, and we could see things, you know, as they unfolded. He could tell me his story, he could show me his story as well as tell me it. And so that first trip away, we're going down to Changsha. He wanted himself to go and see Mao Zedong's birthplace, because Mao had played such a pivotal part in his life, as he did in many Chinese people's lives. So he wanted to go down to Mao's hometown. So we went to Changsha, the city of Changsha. And on this first night, we went into the hotel lobby. And there in the lobby, I thought, well, are we going to share a room, or are we going to get one each? And in the end, I decided we'd get one each. And so we went to our respective rooms, and we decided to meet later on that evening for dinner. So at 8 o'clock, I came out of my hotel room, I closed the door, and I looked down the corridor towards the lifts. And there, standing next to the lift, waiting to go down, was my teacher. But it took me a little while to work out what was different about him. I kind of recognised the face. I didn't recognise the get-up. And there he was, wearing women's clothes. He had trousers on, but they were kind of silky three-quarter length trousers. He had a very tight t-shirt, a padded bra. He had makeup, eyeliner, everything.
A wig, presumably.
He didn't have a wig at that point. He didn't have a wig. He was just wearing his normal hair, and he kind of just sort of like looked at me, saw me walking towards him, and he kind of wafted a hand, down towards his clothes, and he said, "Well, you don't mind, do you?" At which point I said, "No, I don't mind, but you know, maybe we ought to talk about it." So that's how he kind of let me know he was a cross-dresser.
And so did you have no idea up until this point, or were there signs? I mean, you talk in the book how you might have been able to know in hindsight.
Now I think about it, I think of Donald Rumsfeld. I don't know if you remember, a few years ago, he got into all kinds of linguistic difficulties when he talked
about the known knowns and the unknown.
And right. The unknown knowns and the unknown unknowns. I realized afterwards that actually that the teacher's secret was a known unknown. So in the previous 5 years when I'd known him, I had seen certain signs. So, for example, he would turn up at our lessons occasionally in the winter, and he would have kind of what I thought at first was lipstick. Then I thought, no, you guys have lived in Beijing. You know it gets very dry in the winter. You use face cream and lip balm. I thought he was just wearing a colourful lip balm. Sounds very naive, I know. And he would sometimes turn up with tight T-shirts on, or occasionally very elaborate jewellery. On one particular occasion, he went through a very painful facelift. And I kind of wondered, you know, why he'd gone through the facelift in the first place. I didn't want to push him too much because, you know, people have limits. There's limits to all friendships. And I thought that perhaps he would tell me in time. So looking back, there were signs, but I hadn't just picked them up, which I was quite annoyed about with myself for, because obviously as a journalist, you're supposed to be quite observant, supposed to notice things which are going on around you. And I hadn't been looking properly at the person who was sitting opposite me twice a week.
So let's freeze frame there with you standing there, maybe a little bit agog at in the hallway in front of the lift in this hotel in Changsha, and jump backward and do a little flashback. You made your way to China. How did you get interested in China? You grew up in, what, York? Is that right?
In Yorkshire. Right? Yeah, in a small village in Yorkshire in the north of England. I rarely went on holiday. We hadn't much been outside the kind of my immediate area before I went to university in Newcastle, which is a city in the north of England. Once there,
we know the beer.
Yeah, Newcastle Brown Ale. Yeah, I drank quite a lot of it whilst I was up there. And I did something called Politics and East Asian Studies. It was a course for people who wanted to study politics, but wanted to study the politics of countries very different to our own. It also gave you a chance to travel abroad for a year, and that's primarily why I took it. I had no interest in China beforehand, so I really fell into Chinese studies. And it's like many things in our lives. Once we get more involved in something, we become more interested, and more interested, we become more excited, we learn more about it, and it just went on from there. And when I left university, I became a journalist and worked in Britain for 5 or 6 years, but always with a view to at some point going back to China. And I did. I worked at the China Daily for a little while as a polisher, an editor of the work.
Propaganda?
Well, it is propaganda. It looks like a newspaper. Sure. It feels like a newspaper, but yet it is. It's essentially a propaganda tool for the Chinese government. But it offered a way through me and my wife to kind of travel to China and get a feel for the place. And after that, I went to Taiwan and was a stringer for the BBC and other people, and then went back to China, studied Chinese, and got a job with the BBC as a correspondent in 2007. So that's how I ended up being a journalist in China, quite briefly, really.
Well, there's really no shame in having worked for the China Daily. I think a lot of people who find their way to proper journalism start off, polishing turds at a propaganda organ.
Yeah, no, it's a great place. You do get to understand Chinese life. It was a proper Chinese Danwei, so you would understand the kind of way Chinese business life was organized, obviously before the kind of reforms and the opening up to the outside world and the people starting up their own businesses. This was a proper place. So you got really to understand a little bit of how Chinese people lived, how they worked, and what they thought of each other, how they organized themselves. So it certainly wasn't a wasted opportunity.
I remember you mentioned the Roman Gardens. I used to live right up there, right behind Roman Gardens at a place called Lanjiuyuan. And so it was a bit of nostalgia. Remember that, Jeremy?
Yes, I do indeed. The Roman Gardens. Michael, what about the sort of propaganda side of the China Daily? What were your major takeaways from working at a party propaganda organ?
Well, firstly, working as a foreigner there, a lot of it is unseen. So you're not involved in the processes which lead to the kind of selecting of stories and how they're written. My impression was, and I don't know what your guys' impression is, but that a lot of it is a self-censorship. People often in China, the line, nobody knows where the line is about what can and cannot be said. Maybe that's becoming a lot more clear under President Xi Jinping. But for many years, the line, it was difficult to know when you were crossing it. And I think the authorities did that deliberately because people naturally and necessarily to protect themselves would hold back and kind of not write nearly as much as they wanted to for fear of stepping over that line.
I think that's very true. I think you're absolutely on the mark there.
You know, so it was, you know, people trying to wanting to avoid sensitive subjects, so perhaps self-censoring more than the censors would do. So that was my takeaway. But as I said, it was also a kind of a great way to observe how people spoke to each other and the kind of issues of face. So, for example, you know, there would be a public ridiculing. So the kind of the day after the paper was published, it would be print put on the wall, pinned on the wall, and an editor would go through with a marker pen, you know, marking out big mistakes and kind of corrections and areas which hadn't worked. And this was public. Everybody could see it, but nobody would actually talk to each other, or it didn't seem to be in face-to-face terms. So you'd never get an editor bringing somebody in and saying, look, we should have done this better. It was all very public. It was kind of quite humiliating for reporters. And they would never they would never be told quite personally, you know, how to put it right. So it was a real education in terms of sort of like how Chinese people relate to each other in that kind of environment.
Jeremy, maybe we should rethink our humiliation policy at SubChina. I don't know if
we don't humiliate ourselves enough, you mean?
Yeah, public humiliation.
It's one management strategy, that's for sure. Michael, what was the intended readership of this book? It strikes me as a very engaging read that would work very well as an introduction for someone who hasn't had a great deal of exposure to China. It introduces a number of events and people who made news during your time as a journalist there and some of the historical background. Was that the idea of the book?
Yes, it was really. I mean, to anybody who knows China in great depth, perhaps the ideas and themes and the kind of stories that I tell in the book might not come as too much of a surprise. Obviously, the teacher's story is slightly different and it gave me a slightly different angle on what was going on in China. But it was intended for a more general readership. I mean, there are lots of books about China. It is a very serious place where people treat it very seriously, politicians, business people. There are lots of books about the economy. And if you talk to people in Europe, in America, we all know about the Chinese economy and its effect on us, the cheap goods, the investment opportunities, its rise in power, how that's going to use that. So there's a lot of seriousness when it comes to China. But there's also a kind of a lot of humour, which I sometimes feel gets missed. And the kind of the ordinariness of kind of living in China and what people feel and think sometimes gets missed as well. And I wanted to introduce that to a kind of a general readership, someone who has an interest about China, but might not want to read a scholarly book about it or not want to know the whole twists and turns of the kind of workings of the Standing Committee of the Politburo. Somebody might just want a general handle on what it feels like to be in China or to what China is like at this particular point in time.
Yeah, and I think it very much succeeds on that level. It does cover a lot of the major stories that happened, you know, in your tenure there. And boy, I mean, you were there during some pretty eventful times. I mean, if you started at the Beebit in 2007, I mean, you had the whole, oh my God.
The Olympics, run-up to the Olympics.
There was the right, Tibet unrest.
Xinjiang, Bo Xilai. You visited with, you tried to track down Gao Zhisheng and Hu Jia after both of them, you know, disappeared respectively. You tried to make your way to Chen Guangcheng's hometown in Shandong. But you also include, like you said, I think a lot of, I'd call it, you know, quotidian color, just sort of the detail of ordinary life, and I think that fleshes it out very nicely. The hook, obviously, though, is the teacher and his transvestism. And you say you would have written it irrespective of the fact that, you know, you came out into that hallway one night before dinner and Changsha and saw him dressed as a woman. Let's talk about him, though. He's sort of meant as an everyman, and you do use his life experiences, you know, as you said, as a kind of vehicle to tell a story of China. And yeah, he's had it all, the whole cultural revolution struggles and the sent down to the countryside. But as a man who cross-dresses in at least one significant aspect of his life, he's just not at all representative. You know, much more interesting for it, I would say. But how do you square this, the everyman and the fascinating exception in talking about this character?
I suppose, I mean, this is obviously my personal view and other people have different opinions, but being a cross-dresser is kind of one part of this teacher's life. It's not the whole part of his life. He's married. He's got a child. He's had a career. He's got friends. He goes out. He watches films. He does all kinds of things. And I wanted to kind of put this cross-dressing in context of his whole life. Quite often when we talk about minority issues and sexual minorities or gender minorities, you know, we focus on kind of, perhaps rightly, on those particular issues. I didn't want that issue to kind of overwhelm everything else about the teacher, because to him, it's one part of his life. He has a hold-all bag, in which he keeps lots of his clothes, his women's clothes, which he keeps locked away in the boot of his car in this hold-all, which he takes out occasionally. And at other parts of his life, that's all locked away. And I wanted to reflect that a little bit. I didn't want the kind of cross-dressing to become too much a part of what the story was about, because ultimately I feel that that's what all people of whatever minority or whatever, however you deviate from the norm, whatever, however you want to express yourself, you just want to be able to express it in a normal way and be accepted for that without being treated as kind of weird or odd or out of the ordinary. And so I wanted the book to kind of reflect that idea.
Do you think that, Michael, do you think that Chinese people are somewhat better at compartmentalizing their lives in that way than Westerners may be? Because it strikes me as a feature of social life in China, you know, and I include myself in this in my, you know, behavior living in China for 20 years, that I feel as though a lot of people develop an ability to shut off certain parts of their life from their family or from their friends or from their business associates. Does that make any sense?
It does make sense. Yeah, it does make sense. I feel Chinese people are the most practical. I mean, I know that it's a kind of generalization and I don't like generalizations, but perhaps the most practical people I've ever met. You know, how is it that you can have Taoism and Confucianism and Buddhism and Christianity and all these kind of things kind of rolling up against each other? And they don't seem to bring about the contradictions that you might think would arise in, say, Western society. You know, so they, people can seem to believe different things. And as I think I come in, talk about in the book, the teacher was a very practical person. He wouldn't, you know, he could believe one thing one minute and another thing another, and he would take on board one thing that seemed to come from a different philosophical school and another thing from a completely different area of life, and they all seemed to fit together as long as they were useful to him, as long as they served a purpose, because he was trying to live a life the best he could, and he wasn't going to get hung up about hypocrisies or sort of you know, doing one thing one day and another thing another day. So yeah, it does make sense. They're very practical people, I feel, and that's why they're able to kind of cope with so much that's gone on in recent history and to accept and get on with it.
Anyway, Michael, the teacher initially had huge misgivings about you even talking about his cross-dressing. How did he come around to it, and how did you arrive at the compromise that allowed you to go ahead with the book?
Which is basically that you didn't use his name, right?
That's the essence of the book. Yeah, he allowed me eventually to talk about his cross-dressing. I mean, initially I was quite angry, because as soon as he revealed the fact that he was a cross-dresser, I suspected that he would perhaps want to keep that semi-secret existence a semi-secret. And initially, I asked him on that first night, I said, look, you know, I'm writing a book. We're traveling around China. You're dressed as a woman. It has a reaction. I'm going to have to write about this. Because if I don't write about it, then it just won't be honest enough. And he said, look, I'm going to have to think about it. So he thought about it. And a couple of weeks later, I plucked up enough courage to speak to him about it again. We were on a train and we were kind of relaxing. We'd had a dinner and he said, look, I don't want you to mention the cross-dressing, because even, you know, it's going to be in English, but it might be translated. There's the internet now. People, it might come back onto me. And when he said that, I was quite angry, because I thought, well, why bother, you know, going through all this in the first place? Just tell me. And I would have said, fine, okay, I respect your right to privacy. Let's not do the book. I'll think of something else to write, or abandon the project altogether. So I was a little angry with him. And then afterwards, I kind of tried to persuade him. You know, not too hard, but I just said, look, we've done all this work already. We'll have wasted this time. You know, I can't write about it, you know, if you don't let me mention the cross-dressing. I use the example of me going around China with someone who was black. And as you know, there were very few black people in China, and they always elicit a response. Sometimes not a very nice response, but certainly there would be something there that, you know, if you were writing about traveling with someone who was black, you would have to mention that person's colour, because once again, it wouldn't be honest enough. He seemed to understand that, and he seemed to come to a quick conclusion that I could mention his cross-dressing as long as I didn't identify him or, you know, kind of give any information which would lead to his identification. So I've spoken to him since writing the book and since the book was going to be published. And I said to him again, look, you know, I'm writing this book, it's going to be published, we're talking about your cross-dressing, giving him the opportunity once again to pull back. I would have been pretty disappointed if at that point he had said he didn't want the book published, but I did give him the opportunity and he did say, look, fine, good luck. So I think perhaps somewhere deep down, he wants to reveal himself to a kind of a wider audience. This is who he is. He enjoys wearing women's clothes. Why should he not show that to a wider audience?
Does his wife know, Michael?
His wife knows, but doesn't approve. I haven't talked to him in detail recently about that, but at the time I've spoken to him and kind of fairly recently, his wife did know, but doesn't really approve. Whenever I met him with his wife, he was always dressed as a man. He never talked about his cross-dressing. And I think it was, as you were talking earlier, Jeremy, about compartmentalisation of your life. I think that's what he did. She was knew about it, but didn't want anything really to do about it. So he kept it away from her.
And you never really talked to her individually? You never talked to her separately from him?
I didn't. She was quite a, not a frightening woman, but, you know, quite a strident woman. And also, this, as I say, the kind of limits between friendships. I didn't want, I could tell by when I, in my conversations with him, that he was reticent about what his wife knew and his relationship with his wife and his cross-dressing. So I didn't want to kind of trample over that friendship or enter an area where I wasn't welcome. You know, he would have, you know, worn women's clothes in front of his wife. That would have been a different issue. I would have brought it up then. What do you think about it? But because he didn't do that and it was quite clear that he was uncomfortable cross-dressing in front of his wife, I didn't feel it was my place to bring that issue up.
Michael, was the teacher introspective at all about his own predilection for women's clothing? How aware of or how interested was he in transvestism, gender bending, all that more broadly LGBTQ culture in the West? Was that something that he asked you about often? And was it something that you felt like you could help him to get a better understanding of?
Not very much, to be perfectly honest. I think because by the time I'd met him, he'd been cross-dressing all his life, but he'd been publicly doing it since about the year 2000, broadly speaking, when the internet became very popular in China and he'd searched the internet. Up to that point, he'd been very depressed because he thought he'd been alone. Suddenly the internet comes along, he searches for people like him, he finds them, he finds a sense of kind of belonging to a group, he kind of went to clubs, he met other cross-dressers, he had friends who were cross-dressers. So this was a kind of important part of his life. By the time I came into his life and he revealed his cross-dressing to me, he'd already come to terms with it and he already had an established life. And so he didn't really need me to kind of do that. And also, he's quite a confident about himself and who he was. Whenever we were out cross-dressing, he never hid himself, even kind of, you know, walking through a Chinese city street. He would be very confident about who he was. Later on, you mentioned the wig earlier, Kaiser. He wore wigs later on. He would show me kind of his wigs lined up in his hotel and his makeup. And he was very proud of who he was. I remember once walking down the street, he shouted out to a kind of a guy who owned a restaurant. We ate in the restaurant the night before. He said, "Do I look pretty?" You know, kind of showing off. He was a great extrovert. He wanted people to see him dressed as a woman. He didn't mind it, and why should he?
And his personality changed a lot when he was in drag, right?
He did, yes. I mean, he did. He became far softer. It sounds like a cliche, but, you know, he would toss his head from side to side, you know, throw his hair back. He had a kind of very feminine walk. He always struggled on high heels. He always said he felt more comfortable in high heels than in flat men's shoes, but I have to see him walk and I don't believe it really. But he loved to walk in kind of women's high heels. He loved to dress up. He kind of felt comfortable like that.
Michael, how would you characterize Chinese attitudes about transvestism? Are they separate from or part and parcel of broader attitudes towards anything that's not hetero and cis normative, I believe, are the words that one uses now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the conservatism, which, I mean, this is, once again, it's my personal opinion and just, you know, other people have different opinions, but the kind of social conservatism that exists still in Chinese society is, to many respects, kind of invented by the communists. You know, when they came into power, one of their kind of great things they did, they kind of, you know, kind of cleaned up all those flesh pots, you know, Shanghai, Tianjin, wherever, all these kind of treaty ports where Western debauchery had taken hold. And so they were very socially conservative people, but they kind of, you know, swept away a kind of quite a tolerant tradition in Chinese culture. I don't think, I'm not an expert in kind of Taoism and Confucianism, but I don't think they have a lot to say about the morality, sexual morality, as much as, say, the Christian tradition in the West has to say, where we would, and people still look at some aspects of people's behavior and see it as sinful. I don't think they, traditionally, Chinese people have that same idea.
That makes sense to me. I mean, I think the Westerners didn't actually bring the flesh pots. They brought the Puritanism.
Yeah, I agree. And that was adopted by the communists. And whenever we traveled around China, you know, with the teacher dressed as a woman, I never met any anger or potential violence. Now, if I was even in London and I was walking around with someone who's a cross-dresser, let alone going back to my hometown in the north of England where attitudes aren't quite as advanced, going around some of these places, I would be slightly cautious that we would bump into people who might not like what the teacher was wearing and might take offence at that. In China, that never happened. And all credit to Chinese people for that.
Do you think attitudes are changing or becoming, reverting to a form of tolerance then? I mean, now we have Jin Xing, who's, I think, China's most famous transgender woman, the dancer and choreographer. She's on TV practically every day on one of the most popular shows. I mean, do you think there's a shift in tolerance?
I do. There was a survey done by, well, sponsored by the UN Peking University in Beijing LGBT Center last year, which kind of had a mixed picture. It sort of like said people were still sexual minorities, gender minorities, these groups of people still feel fearful about revealing themselves, who they are in public. Just one in 20 feel confident enough to do that. But also this report said that actually Chinese society in general is moving towards more acceptance and tolerance and a kind of gender equality, and same-sex marriage is a kind of, it's not there in China yet, but it's an issue which is certainly talked about. Earlier this year we had the Supreme Court in Taiwan, a kind of place which is a great Chinese culture and essentially Chinese people. I know that you could argue that they're Taiwanese, but that's a nationality issue rather than an ethnic issue. You know, in Taiwan, where the Supreme Court has decided to kind of that same-sex marriage is illegal, you see there some of the Chinese attitudes are very accepting. So I think Chinese people generally are quite accepting and moving towards that. In some respects, rediscovering their tolerant past, which was obscured by the communists.
Yeah, I certainly agree. That matches with what I've observed in Chinese society. Was the teacher interested in the activism on behalf of the LGBTQ community? Was he up on what was happening with groups who were active in working to promote gay and queer and lesbian and bisexual rights?
No, is the simple answer. He never spoke to me about it. He never indicated he was interested in that. I mean, you've got to remember, this man is now in his 60s. He's lived a long life. He's done a lot of things and been through a lot of hardships. And the final hurdle I felt that he had to overcome was kind of finding a place for his cross-dressing. And once he realized that there were people like him, he was just seemed to me to be happy with that situation. I think had he been a younger person, other issues would have presented themselves. So, for example, you know, he was retired. He had enough money to live on. He could cross-dress whenever he wanted. When he didn't want to, he didn't have to. But had he been younger, he might have felt he wanted to go to work wearing women's clothes. That might have presented more difficulties, you know, that perhaps wouldn't have been accepted, that perhaps would have drawn him into activism. And we've seen there's been a number of legal cases where people have tried to kind of assert their what they feel is their right to go to work in China, dressed as they see fit. And so perhaps if he'd have been younger and these issues had kind of jarred with the way he lived his life, he would have been drawn into activism most, but more than he was. But, you know, when I met him, as I said, he kind of retired. So he was just happy to kind of be himself and happy he could be himself.
Michael, I meant to ask you earlier, has he actually read the book now?
He hasn't. And I'm hoping he does. He doesn't speak English. So
right.
He would have difficulty reading the book, but I'm hoping I might get translated. Certainly, I will have to sort of like, you know, go to China pretty soon, hopefully, and kind of talk to him about him and go through the book with him. That's something that kind of I have to do pretty soon.
We talked about how the teacher is really, you know, very representational. That he does kind of embody the zeitgeist. And one of the ways that I really noticed that he does represent that very well is that he gets bitten by the entrepreneurial bug. Can you talk about his business ideas and how, like so many of mine, it too failed?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things I loved about the teacher, because whenever I would sort of like have something I was working on, say at the BBC, you know, he'd say, "Oh I know something about that," or "I know somebody who did that," or he'd already have a story, and he kind of have these stories, like just he'd pick them out of his pocket, and, you know. So he'd talk about businesses, and he would say, "Yeah." No, actually, the business one, I found out about it because I arrived at our lesson one day, and he'd already arrived, and he was sat at his desk, and he was kind of holding this piece of paper, and it had a list of items for sale on this list. So I said to him, "Well, what's that then?" You know. That's a karaoke machine. What are you selling a karaoke machine for? And so then he told me about this kind of homestay business that he'd started up to the south of Beijing, just outside of the city. Now, homestays, for those who don't know them, are sort of like places which became very popular while I was in Beijing, where people would leave the city on a weekend and they would go to the countryside. They would maybe pick vegetables. They would eat kind of what they thought was as kind of cleaner food, more healthy food. They would get out to the mountain air. They would kind of shake down the dust of the city and just kind of enjoy themselves and relax. And the teacher had seen this and he'd tried to kind of open his own. Unfortunately, he'd done it to the south of Beijing, which is not nearly as pretty as the north, with the mountains and kind of the Great Wall snaking over the mountains. Really, I mean, obviously, you've been there. It's kind of a really...
The flat wastelands between Beijing and Tianjin, essentially.
Exactly. So we drove to this place, and I could tell I was kind of quite depressed. There was a smog hanging over. There were kind of workshops and motorways. And I thought, why on earth would he kind of open a place in this place? And then we kind of got to this place, and it was in the process of falling down, you know, in kind of China, where when they build a wall, the kind of the cement is never sort of like, you know, done neatly, and there's kind of holes between the bricks, and it looks just awful. And then I notice, hang on, that's a coffin maker next to this place where you'd open a place where people are going to come and relax and entertain themselves, you know. Surely you realize Chinese people are probably one of the most superstitious people on earth, you know, and anything associated with death or dying is a complete taboo, isn't it? Why on earth did you possibly feel that this would go ahead? And, you know, he just said, well, you know, this was the only place that my kind of relative who was opening it with had available, and just kind of laughed. But it summed him up. He wasn't a businessman. He kind of considered himself a bit of an intellectual. I think he went into business just to kind of, just for the fun of it, just for the people he would meet, because he was a great raconteur. He still is a great raconteur, you know, talking to people and meeting different people, and, you know, just sat down talking hours on end. And that's probably why he opened the business in the first place.
Well, that makes sense. I think in some ways that's the best motive for opening a business in China is for fun, because profit is much more difficult to attain.
You know, and he wanted me to go. We kind of went to this business and we looked at the building, nothing much to see, but he wanted to go and visit the woman he'd employed as a cook. And she was a great character, you know, and it kind of, there was a scene in the book, and I think it's important I wanted to show this scene because it's important. You would have some of the most fantastic meals in China in the most inauspicious venues. You know, and this woman was cooking a meal, and she had a kind of a chopping board, a chopper, and a kind of a ring with a wok on, and a kind of a rubber hose leading to a gas cylinder. And, you know, it looked the worst place possible to prepare food. And there she did, prepared this meal for workmen at this workplace she was working at. And it just kind of reminded me of all the fantastic food I'd had in China. And when you come to London, you go to some fantastically smart restaurants that look so chic, and then you go in and the food's just really average and just kind of, it's so depressing.
Yeah, no, that you know, China ruins you in that way. You no longer care that much about the decor. It's just the food. Michael, I'd like to ask you about something that's not actually in the book, but that you could perhaps talk about. The last few years since you've been back from China have seen what some consider a fairly unseemly kowtowing by the British government to Beijing in the pre-Brexit days when Cameron was still Prime Minister. Xi Jinping's state visit was said by various government spokespeople and private sector business people to be the beginning of a so-called golden era in Sino-British relations. That was just 2 years ago, in October 2015. And I mean, since then, the country, Britain, seems like America to have been excited by some kind of animal spirits and xenophobic ideas, which certainly seems to be one factor in the yes vote to Brexit in 2016. How does the golden era of Sino-British relations look now in 2017 in September? And what are the chattering classes saying about China in London?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that, you know, America has always been more serious about China than Britain. And so that's one thing. So I kind of, Britain's disengagement with kind of China, say, over issues such as Hong Kong, doesn't really come as a surprise, because whenever that's, we're more kind of concerned about our own place in Europe over the last few years than looking towards China. But yeah, you're right to talk about this golden age. In fact, I've just been to an event this evening where I've kind of listened to a speech by the Chinese ambassador to Britain, Liu Xiaoming, talking just about that, the kind of golden age and how it's building momentum. He was at a function where there was a university building ties with a Fudan University in Shanghai. And so for some people, this is still a kind of burning issue. But I feel that it's an unequal partnership. China knows that Britain leaving Europe, it's going to need all the friends it can. It's going to need all the trading partners it can. And China is in a good bargaining position. And it knows that. So it doesn't have to kind of push that hard. So it's a kind of quite a desperate and a sad situation in some respects to see Britain diminished really in the eyes of China and as a kind of relationship. I did a report recently to kind of mark the 20th anniversary of the handover of Hong Kong back to China from Britain. And I spoke to one of the chief diplomat involved in the negotiations, the chief British diplomat involved in negotiations with China 20 years ago. And he said, there's absolutely no way we would have able to have negotiated the deal we got for Hong Kong then now, because we're just so much more diminished.
I recall a Global Times opinion piece a few years ago that said something along the lines of, Britain is a small country of interest for tourism and educating our children, but not much else, which seemed to sum up the new dismissive attitude.
It's a style place, really. Britain, the kind of this idea of Victorian Britain and the kind of gentleman clubs and this kind of this idea of Britain is why I think a lot of kind of Chinese parents send their kids to Britain to study, because they think they're getting this kind of classical British education. I mean, to a certain extent, that's just kind of smoke and mirrors. It's a Britain which doesn't exist, but it's certainly...
Don't tell anybody.
Yeah, exactly. It's certainly benefiting the education industry in Britain. I mean, it's kind of one of our biggest earners.
Yeah, I mean, Xi Jinping may bang on about his commitments to globalism, but the truth is China would rather deal with a fractured Europe. They'd rather deal individually, bilaterally with countries rather than with the EU. And so while nominally they were pro-Remain, I think there were probably a few people who smiled at the outcome last summer with Brexit.
Yeah, they're definitely. I'm sure actually China's probably happy at our slight discomfort. I mean, actually, this event I went to this evening, I also met a Swiss diplomat who said he'd met some Chinese officials, really, and he said they were okay. He was surprised because they were really nonplussed about Britain leaving the European Union, and they were just kind of quite relaxed about it. Well, I said they will be, won't they? Because they know that we need them more than they need us. That's just the dynamics at the moment.
Michael, as a podcaster, I have the last general question about the BBC and its fate. In 2011, I think it was, the BBC World Service stopped Mandarin broadcasts, but the Chinese news website seems to have expanded, actually, and you know, it's a pretty decent source of news in Chinese about the world. I noticed that the BBC also launched a West African pigeon news site. So where do you think the BBC is going with its foreign language coverage, and how important is China and the Chinese language news going to be toward, you know, in the organization's concerns going forward?
Well, I'll deal with your last question first. The thing about China, China's extremely important. And although they stopped the BBC World Service stopped broadcasting in radio in Mandarin, they have this kind of website which you've seen, and they're committed to it. It's part of the change, the way people access news. People just don't listen to radio quite as much as they did previously. They access
That's
news
sure.
in other
yeah.
ways. And so the change to online is happening with a number of kind of language services here at the BBC. The Vietnamese service is another one, the Chinese service, as you just mentioned there. So certainly the BBC is committed. In actual fact, over the last few years, the government, as you've mentioned as well there with the launch of the pigeon service, also Korean service, which is just in the process of being launched at the moment, an entirely new service. You know, kind of they're launching a kind of few meters away from where I'm sitting talking to you now. The BBC, the government in Britain gave money to the BBC to kind of expand its language services across the world. Essentially, they realised that, you know, Britain's best way of promoting itself was this soft power. And Britain does still, for a kind of middling world power, still punch above its weight in terms of culture, in terms of soft power. People know about Britain, know about artists, musicians. The BBC World Service is a global brand, and a kind of just the government and the BBC has realised that by telling the world what's going on in the world, that's a great gift. And, you know, I kind of proud actually to be part of that, because it is what? To provide information to people out there.
I'm very happy to hear that. Actually, I listen to BBC news in the form of podcasts, and I mean it remains a fantastic news organization that gives a lot greater depth and breadth than you get from, you know, even NPR in the United States. I mean, you know, if you're interested in Africa, like I am,
Then listen in the middle of the night and you hear that terrific one, right?
Yeah,
great anyway. Shows. I'm also really glad to see that the BBC has opened up to more than just received pronunciation, so that we get voices like yours now, your funny northern vowels.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. I mean, I can remember when I first started working at the BBC, this is only about 10 years ago, I did a voiceover. So there was Ariel Sharon, who was the Prime Minister of Israel at the time. And of course, you can see where this story is going, can't you? But, you know, we had to do, obviously he spoke in Hebrew, and, you know, I had to do a voiceover as part of a sort of like a radio bulletin that was going out. And when my voice sort of like came on air and I was in this kind of open plan newsroom, people started laughing because it was so ridiculous.
Imagine.
It was ridiculous that you would have a northern English British voice on the BBC. Now people wouldn't do that, as times have changed quite a lot. You know, there's room for all accents, because out there in the real world, people speak in all different ways. And thankfully, the BBC is waking up to that.
They wear all sorts of different clothes. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to, you know, share your stories about the teacher. Again, the book is called China in Drag, Travels with a Crossdresser, and it's a very lively, very short, and very readable book that I'd love it if we helped you move some copies off the shelves.
That would be good.
Let's stick around. Let's make some recommendations. Yeah?
Yep. I've got my recommendation ready.
Oh, good. Well, before we get to that, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. You can follow SupChina on Facebook at facebook.com/SupChinaNews or, of course, on Twitter at SupChinaNews. Jeremy, let's kick it off. What do you have for us this week?
Okay, it is themalamarket.com, M-A-L-A market.com, which is, if you're in the United States, a little business run by some friends of mine here in Nashville, Tennessee. It's a mother-daughter combination, a Nashvillian who adopted a daughter from China who loves Sichuan food.
Because it's genetic. So
it's genetic, I think. Well, she was actually quite, she was 11 when she came to the United States. She wasn't adopted as a baby, so she already had a taste for good food. And her mom learned to cook Sichuan food and is now selling really fine Sichuan ingredients, you know, including Sichuan peppers, huajiao, and all kinds of sauces and little, you know, things you need to make various kinds of Sichuan dishes. So it's themalamarket.com. They also have a blog, which I think they're changing the name of, but it's currently called the Mala Project, which is the same name as a restaurant in New York. I rather like, which is also a recommendation, but I think I've made that one before. Finally, I would also like, you mentioned the BBC's new West African pigeon news service. And I mean, I love West African pigeon. I had a lot of Nigerian friends in Beijing. And I've started reading the news in pidgin occasionally, and it's really a wonderful experience to enjoy this form of English that is so different from what was ever presented on the BBC previously.
Great recommendation. I'll definitely listen to that. Michael, what do you have for us?
Well, I'm going to be very, very boring. I'm going to recommend a book that I've just read. Apologies for that. But it's called A Whole Life, and it's by an author, an Austrian author, called Robert Seethaler. And it's just about an ordinary guy who lives in a valley in the Alps in Austria, and nothing happens to him in his entire life, or very little that's noteworthy. But he's kind of the essence of his life, and the kind of, he's lived a full and rich life by the end of it. And it kind of reminds me a little bit of a book, I don't know if you read it, Stoner, that kind of a lot of people in Britain were reading. It's by the American author John Williams. It was rediscovered, I think, a few years ago, about a Midwestern university
aficionado of cannabis.
No, so that's, it's just kind of a book, and it chimes with my book a little bit, because it's about somebody who's done seemingly nothing but lived a fantastic life. And I think that we all should learn a little bit of that for our own life.
The kind of book I'd be able to write.
Oh, Kaiser.
Okay, I'm gonna outboring you. I'm gonna do some gear. I'm just loving the fact that there's so much good Chinese electronics gear out there on the market now. You can buy it in the States. My most recent acquisition was some amazing. I'm having them in my ears right now, even as we speak. Some in-ear monitors, earbuds, by a company called One More. The number one, M-O-R-E. They're apparently part of the whole Xiaomi family of tech gadgetry. They're these triple driver earphones. I don't know if that means anything to anyone, but that means, you know, there's
no
separate drivers for the bass, the mid-range, and for the treble. They're just a huge step up from what you're probably using right now. I mean, just amazing clarity. And they're only like $95, unless you get the gold-colored ones, which are inexplicably like $50 more. But
Inexplicably? It's got gold on it.
No, they're gold-colored. Anyway, they also make this quad driver model, which is a bit more pricey, but which I'm told is something that I'll have to move up to at some point. But these are just amazing. I mean, I've been soliciting suggestions for really, really high quality recordings to just sort of spin on these, irrespective of genre or musicianship, just for the quality of the production, you know, along lines of Steely Dan's Asia. Which, you know, I've been listening to a lot anyway after Walter Becker's untimely passing. So, yeah, they're great. Great headphones. Just amazing. So, Michael, thanks once more for joining us on Seneca. It was a lot of fun talking to you. And thanks so much for turning us on to the book.
Yeah, thanks, sir. Thanks for interviewing me.
Yeah, best of luck with it, too. Jeremy, good to talk to you, man.
Yes, likewise. Thank you, Kaiser. Thanks, Michael.
Enjoy the rest of your holiday. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Thanks, as always, to Anla Chang and to Soraya Darabi from SubChina. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/subchinanews and follow us on Twitter at subchinanews. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.